At Farm to Table, we know how confusing healthcare is. We're here to simplify the healing process. We believe that healthcare should be simple. It should help people feel better. That's why we started the Table Talk podcast, to gather around the table with you, no matter where you are. We want to come and learn together and discuss a new healthcare approach that addresses the root cause of your symptoms. The journey for each person is unique, but together we can thrive. Hi, welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I have two of our pharmacists here from the Farm to Table team, and we're ready to talk about a super hot topic that a lot of people experience, which is cholesterol. So today is all about cholesterol. And so I have Dr. Veronica from Texas. You want to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Dr. Veronica Riera-Gilley. I'm in Sherman, Texas, and I'm a board-certified geriatric pharmacist.
Awesome. Thank you. And we have Dr. Sarah from Montana.
Hello.
And both of these pharmacists have been on the podcast before. So welcome back, ladies. So today, again, we are just really going to hone in on cholesterol because this is something that in everybody's blood panel, you go to the doctor every year and you are going to talk about cholesterol. So we really want to give you guys sort of the lowdown on cholesterol, and I'm going to let Sarah take it away to get started.
All right. So I kind of like that as a team, we get to choose the topics that we pop on and we get to be on the podcast for, and we all choose the topics that have a particular interest to us for whatever reason. And sometimes it's just that we're pharmacists and we like this a certain topic. But I know for you, Melody, your interest is partially because your husband has high cholesterol. And then for me, my grandma did, my dad does. And then I found out that I actually have high cholesterol. I was 19 when I found out. So it's kind of always been on my mind. I did a exercise study and they looked at the effect of cholesterol and how it related to how much you exercised or how little you exercised. It was pretty fun for, you know, a 19-year-old, but found out that
you probably got paid too, right?
I'm pretty sure everything's volunteer when you're in college. Or maybe it was like $20. Oh. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know. I don't remember.
Not your lunch.
Yeah. So I'll chat a little bit more about my testing later when we get into the particular types of testing. But Veronica, what was your interest into it? And then you can take it over and tell us a little bit more about cholesterol and why we're here talking about that today.
My interest in cholesterol is that I have low cholesterol, and I've been working to get my cholesterol up to help support my hormone production. And I'm also interested in cholesterol because my husband's family has a history of heart disease on both sides, and I'm looking to be proactive in the things we're doing for our family to make sure I keep his heart health good and that I set him up for healthy cholesterol levels. Heart disease is the number one killer of both men and women in the United States. So let's talk about how we can avoid having this problem in our bodies. We want to live a long, healthy life, and we're going to discuss the role that our blood cholesterol plays in heart disease. Cholesterol is a fat-like waxy substance that helps our bodies build healthy cell membranes. And cholesterol is the backbone of many of our hormones, like our sex hormones, estrogen, and testosterone. And it's also important for vitamin D production. It becomes a problem when we have too much cholesterol in addition to inflammation going on in our bodies. And these two together can increase our risk of laying down plaque or sticky buildup on the insides of our arteries. And this is called atherosclerosis. And when we have atherosclerosis happening in our bodies, we can have these pieces of plaque that can break loose and then get lodged somewhere and cause heart attack or stroke.
The other cool thing about cholesterol, well, not cool thing, but I think like the thing to think about is that not only is this like a chronic inflammation, but it's also there's an immune dysfunction going on in the process and how this atherosclerosis builds up due to this chronic inflammation. So we talk a lot about balancing our immune system and helping not activate certain receptors and inflammatory pathways and oxidative stress. And just to think that it's also happening in this cardiovascular system and not just all the other systems that we talk about on the podcast is really interesting too.
Having high cholesterol has no obvious symptoms, so it's important that we're getting this measured with annual blood work. So conventional lab testing is going to measure our total cholesterol, LDL, HDL, and triglycerides. And we've been told that LDL is our bad cholesterol and HDL is our good cholesterol. And we're finding out that there's more to our cholesterol blood work, and we're going to dive into some of those other more advanced cholesterol testing that we could have done for a deeper dive and a better picture of our heart health.
Awesome. Yeah. So from a conventional standpoint, like Veronica said, have our total cholesterol, we have triglycerides, we have our LDL and our HDL. And, you know, even when I was in residency, we were doing a lipid clinic and we were very much just looking at those four numbers and adjusting medications just on those numbers and not really looking at the whole picture. And so when we look at the whole picture, we can actually do what's called a particle size lipid panel, where we can actually see the size of the particles. Because if you think of these lipoproteins like cars on a road, the roads are your arteries like we described, and inside those cars are these cholesterol and fat as their passengers. And so the more cars on the road, there are more bumps in the road with that inflammation that we talked about, the more problematic this is going to be for the arteries. And so when we look at these particle size, we know that the small, dense LDL are actually driving more inflammation and they're more atherogenic. So that means there's more likely that plaques are forming the arteries. And so we usually see more small, dense LDL in conditions like diabetes and blood sugar related conditions, patients with obesity, even patients with some autoimmune conditions. So again, that inflammation is driving these smaller, more dense LDL particles and causing there to be more risk for cardiovascular disease. There's also something called ApoB, which is a key structural component of all these atherogenic lipoprotein molecules. And so that's something that can be tested as well, just beyond the typical lipid panel. And so we're looking to make sure there's not a high amount of these small, dense LDL, also not a high amount of LDL particles in general, because those two things are really strongly positively correlated with heart disease. And the other thing to think about is something called LP little a. And so most regular practices are not, or I shouldn't say regular practice, but conventional practices are not measuring LP little a, but some of your more advanced, maybe concierge type practices or people that are doing a really extensive cardiovascular wellness assessment are looking at LP little a, because LP little a is actually independently associated with cardiovascular risk. And so this is a piece of the cholesterol molecule, and it increases your likelihood of heart attack or stroke, especially if you have familial hypercholesteremia. So this runs in your family. But like LDL cholesterol, LP little a cholesterol can build up in the walls of your arteries, and the higher level is, the more likely this is to happen. Again, those plaques. It also causes increased clotting, which can lead to rapidly formed blockages in those blood vessels, and it also promotes inflammation. So it's definitely something, if you have a family history of parents or other family members that females that had a stroke or heart attack before the age of 65, or males that had a heart attack or stroke before the age of 55, and also, you know, just general cardiovascular risk in your family, diabetes, obesity, high LDL, like these are the patients that really need screened for this LP little a by measuring that in their blood levels. So it's definitely something to really consider. I had a patient in my last practice that was that whole picture. His dad had a heart attack early, uncle had a heart attack early, and we ran it and his LP little a was high. And so the question, which we're going to talk about further, is what do we do with that information? Again, it's an independent risk factor. Even patients on statins and cholesterol lowering medications didn't get as much benefit from those as the patients that were not LP little a, did not have high LP little a. So definitely something to think about. There are no medications at this time other than niacin, which we can talk about towards the end, but niacin can address LP little a, but we don't necessarily have hard endpoints in those patient populations as far as like decreased risk of death or decreased risk of stroke or MI, but we do have a company that is working on a medication to silence that gene. So it'd be interesting to see if that comes to light. But other things to think about on those more expansive lipid panels are a low HDL particle number is a good, if you have a low amount, it can be a good predictor of heart disease risk. But the HDL size or number mass is what's tested on conventional panels. And that does not matter as much as far as heart disease risk. And actually there's some studies and data suggesting that like really high HDL numbers, and I don't know if we want to get into this too much, but the higher the HDL, it can actually be almost like dysfunctional HDL. So it's really important that a high HDL particle number is the most protective, and that whole mass that's tested on a traditional panel is only about 20% of the HDL particle numbers. So those are the basics of things. And then there's some other labs, like from a cardiovascular risk standpoint, that I think are important to look at. One is called myeloperoxidase. And so this is actually a number that is, it's a leukocyte-driven enzyme that sort of breaks down the formation of reactive oxygen species. So again, looking at the inflammatory component of cardiovascular disease and not just these straight LDL numbers. And then the other thing that we can look at from a cardiovascular risk standpoint is oxidized LDL. So the oxidized LDL test is a little bit different. Again, it's looking at how much of your bad cholesterol has been, that LDL cholesterol, if we're still terming it the bad cholesterol, has been modified by oxidation. And again, oxidation is a form of that inflammation. And so when we look at this whole picture, someone's cholesterol levels could be just mildly elevated. But if we look at their picture and we've got small, dense LDL particles and we've got oxidized LDL, we have high myeloperoxidase or we have high LP little a, that might change how we address lifestyle modifications with the patient, or it might change how we overall look at the patient. But then also on these like somewhat more traditional, but still more functional panels, they have smaller, dense LDL, high LDL particles. They have high triglycerides. We didn't even get into triglycerides yet. And then low HDL particles and then high blood pressure patients often have. They often have diabetes, and smoking status can also be a picture. So let's talk a little bit about triglyceride levels, because I skipped over that in the panel. But this high triglycerides really do increase your risk of heart disease and stroke. They also are associated with metabolic syndrome. So patients that have too much fat around their waist and high blood pressure, those patients. And so these are actually produced in the liver and oftentimes are correlated with really high glucose levels. Some of my patients that present with really high triglycerides have really high blood sugars. And so when we balance the blood sugars, the triglycerides can decrease. Some patients also may be taking a medication that increases triglycerides. So diuretics, sometimes certain birth control tablets, progestins and estrogens can increase triglycerides, steroids, some blood pressure medication, even some HIV medications can make triglycerides go up. So we definitely want to evaluate the medication piece and make sure that it's not a medication-induced cause. But fatty liver and diabetes can be a really big cause of high triglycerides. And again, really high triglycerides, like over 500, can also trigger acute inflammation in the pancreas and contribute to pancreatitis. So that's when it's really important to make sure we reduce them. And so that might look different depending on if we're also taking care of really high blood sugars and we're bringing them down that way, or if someone might need medication therapy to bring them down because they're so high. They really store these unused calories. And so when we have this excess glucose, excess calories, we start to get these excess triglycerides in our blood. So that's a little bit about triglycerides, but let's move on to Sarah's going to talk a little bit about her functional blood chemistry and what that looked like and some of the root cause analysis piece of that.
All right. So yeah, like I said, I've had high cholesterol. And when Melody and I were at one of our fellowship modules for the American Academy of Anti-Aging Medicine, Dr. Houston was discussing the cholesterol levels. And he made a statement that anybody who has an HDL or good cholesterol, that's if you're a woman, if it's over 80, if you're a man, if it's over 60, then you likely have dysfunctional cholesterol. And that is not a good thing that we've always been told. We've always been told the higher, the better. And so I raised my hand. I was like, my HDL is close to 100 and it has been since I was 19. And he said, have you ever done a functional blood cholesterol panel? And I said, no. And then he said, I suggest you do that. And then you're going to have to do an HDL function test too. So getting into that, the HDL function test, in addition to the particle number that Melody was discussing, is another really good predictor of heart disease as far as how it relates to the HDL in particular. And the reason for that is that the amount of cholesterol being carried by the high density lipoproteins, when it becomes 80, it's dysfunctional. So it's like having dump trucks. So the HDL takes all the gunk out. A good way of thinking of it is as a dump truck. And so then these dump trucks, they just become dysfunctional, as in they have flat tires and they no longer work. So that just is something that happens at a certain point, and they've found that to be
so basically
around then. So I'm waiting on that test to come back.
So basically HDL in that analogy, there's so much of it that these trucks can't do their job in like getting it out. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Like they just don't work anymore at some point. And I think that that's when it starts to build up. It's not necessarily that there's so many of them that it happens, but they show their dysfunction by getting to a higher level than they typically would sit at. And as the dump truck, then they just have flat tires. So you have a bunch of them and it looks like you're doing a really good job at getting rid of all the junk in your arteries, but you're not, because they can't move. So they're just sitting there and there's a bunch of them and they look great.
But in the conventional model, like if we would see a level of 100, right, we would be like, woohoo, you have the best HDL in the world, right?
Yeah. We get gold stars. I'm always like, oh, your HDL it cancels out my LDL is also above 100, but just by a little bit. So like, oh, that cancels it out. Right. It's fine.
Okay, cool. So what kind of test, what's your testing look like?
Yeah, everything looked pretty good, actually. So waiting on the HDL function, my particle numbers were perfect and the sizes were good. So my functional cholesterol panel looked good. So now I'm awaiting, since I did that and it was fine, I am intrigued to see what the HDL function test turns up. But it's been a process to get that result. Yeah. So outside of the like conventional and functional testing that we've been discussing, there's other things that we actually look at when somebody shows up and is one of our patients and they've got high cholesterol. And that's where we get back to root cause, functional medicine. And with functional medicine, we're always trying to find the root cause, right? So there are other testing methods that we do when we have patients come to us with high cholesterol. And one of the biggest ones and the biggest factor really is insulin resistance. And Melody already talked a bit about that, but it's a huge heart disease risk factor, and it contributes in just increasing the cholesterol and adding to the heart disease risk, but can do that. And that can be a reason why somebody might present with high cholesterol. So when we're looking to test insulin resistance, we're looking to test things like fasting blood sugar, fasting insulin, hemoglobin A1C, the oral glucose tolerance test, and other markers like within that cholesterol panel that can indicate insulin resistance would be high triglycerides and low HDL. So the insulin resistance is a cause of inflammation, which then we've already discussed is one of the main causes of heart disease. So then another root cause that we look at can be low thyroid function. So when we're testing for that to see if that's why somebody's presenting with high cholesterol, we look at the TSH, we look at free T3 and T4, total T3 and T4, and reverse T3. And that can give us an idea on their thyroid function. And if you're looking at that, often low thyroid is autoimmune or Hashimoto's. So it's good to add in the antibodies to test to see if it is an autoimmune thyroid disease. So the other root causes could be infection, and any type of infection can cause your cholesterol to go a little wild. And gut testing is something that we definitely look at, because there have been studies that show that certain gut bacteria can disrupt the metabolism of these lipids. And then we look for toxins. In particular, we all have heard about BPA. That's one that can mess with our cholesterol, and mercury can as well. Our team is pretty big on making sure that we decrease our toxic load. So we often run our 14-day resets, and that is to decrease those toxins in our bodies and to just do a full mind-body reset. So make sure to sign up for our newsletter or follow us on on social media to make sure you catch when our next reset is. And then, what do you know, we're talking about stress again. Stress can increase cholesterol. And so we're back to that. The hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis dysfunction can also cause dysfunction in our cholesterol. And stress is one of the biggest toxins to our heart in general. So not just an effect on cholesterol, but really hard on the heart. And then another root cause would just be people that have unhealthy behaviors in their diet and their lifestyle. And so that's some of the ways that people present to us when we're diving in and trying to figure out how to treat their cholesterol. We don't just treat the cholesterol. We look at the root cause and into all the factors.
Awesome. Yeah. Veronica's going to talk a little bit more about the guidelines for cholesterol. So take it away, Veronica.
So the last guideline for the management of blood cholesterol was released in 2018, and they recommend using a statin in our patients who have had an MI, or that's a heart attack, a stent placement, or coronary artery bypass surgery, or if you have known cardiovascular disease or diabetes. It's recommended that all of these patients be on a statin. And we use statins not in all of our patients. We treat everyone as an individual, and it may be appropriate for a patient to be on a statin, but we're also going to help them make lifestyle changes and exercise changes, since we know that those are very powerful influencers of our cholesterol numbers, and they can help those statin drugs to work better. So for our patients that do need a statin, they can help that statin work better and potentially use the lowest dose possible of a statin by using it alongside different food choices and moving your body more. One of the downfalls of using statins is that they can cause micronutrient depletions, such as coenzyme Q10, tocopherols, tocotrienols, omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin D, vitamin K2, vitamin A, heme A, selenium, carnitine, copper, zinc, and creatine. And it's important, if you're using a statin for the management of your heart disease and high cholesterol, that you're taking measures to replenish those in your body. Because when we're missing out on key nutrients that help feed the powerhouses of our cells, like our mitochondria rely on that antioxidant CoQ10. And it's really important that we replenish those stores to keep our body working optimally. So if you're going to start a statin therapy, it's best to have a micronutrient test and then start your statin and retest your micronutrients in 3 to 4 months so that you can keep an eye on these micronutrient depletions and make sure that you're able to replenish enough when you're using them. So we want to stress that statins are not bad, but they're not for everyone, and they're going to be used on a very individual basis.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, there's data that shows that they have prevent heart attack and stroke. But we do, with that data, have to take that with like looking at the bigger picture and how many people you have to treat for a period of time to see those benefits. So in one meta-analysis that they looked at, the statin use in over 90,000 participants across 14 trials, they found that you had to treat 83 people to have a benefit in preventing death. And then you had to treat at least 39 people to prevent one non-fatal heart attack, and at least 125 people to prevent stroke. So that's a lot of people that are taking it that may not be seeing that benefit, because there's a lot of, we just talked about all these different labs and a lot of factors that go into cardiovascular disease. So it's not just like this LDL number that's a piece of it, which is part of the reason probably that we don't see 100% of our patients looking better, because there's a lot of different factors. And then there's also, like Veronica mentioned, some of the muscle pains with CoQ10 depletion. So 1 in 10 patients on statins, and this particular, there's probably different data points depending on what article you're looking at, but this particular study source or meta-analysis showed 1 in 10 people have the muscle damage or muscle pain. And then than 1 in 50 people actually develop diabetes. And so that piece is really interesting to me because, you know, is it the nutrient depletion, the mitochondrial dysfunction of the statins, or is it microbiome related? Because we're learning more and more about the microbiome and how the influence of the microbiome affects metabolism of statins. And then also just even, you know, the statins actually affecting the microbiome, decreasing the bacteria that we need to trigger some of these endocrine processes. And so I think we discussed a little bit about that statin mechanism on our medication-induced microbiome disruption podcast. So just something to think about, that when we're putting these things in our bodies, sometimes there are alterations in the microbiome or in the nutrients that need supported if we do feel like that this is the best interest of the patient, which in some cases, like Veronica mentioned, it is. And in other cases, the patient and the provider may decide that they're going to use alternative therapies to target that risk reduction. And I think the challenge with the alternative therapy piece is that we don't have as much of these hard endpoints with CV data or cardiovascular risk reduction data. We don't have 90,000 people to look at that took fish oil we probably do with fish oil, but or took, you know, red yeast rice or something instead of a statin. And so we have to take the data that we have and decipher that, again, look at characteristics of patients that were taking it, and then determine, you know, where to go from there. But some of the medications that we do have a good amount of data are on niacin. And niacin is actually available as a prescription medication, also available as a supplement. The key is that if you are looking for the cardiovascular risk reduction benefit, we don't want the non-flush version. You need to flush to be able to have that benefit. So studies don't support the decrease in coronary events in the patients that took the non-flush version. To try to avoid like severe flushing, starting at low doses, titrating slowly, so 100 milligrams every week, you can increase that up. And the goal doses really are 1 to 4 grams, depending on what you're trying to do, because it does affect total cholesterol, LDL, ApoB, the LDL particles size. Sometimes it increases triglycerides. We have to watch that a little bit, but sometimes lowers it. And then the Lp(a), like I mentioned, can be impacted by niacin. The challenge with niacin, again, that it's not super well tolerated. So other things that you can do to help with the flushing, there's a supplement called quercetin that helps to reduce mast cells triggering. And so mast cells are the cells that hold the histamine. And so they help stabilize the mast cells. And so that can help with a flushing piece. And then sometimes if patients are taking, and not that everyone needs a baby aspirin, but if someone is taking a baby aspirin for cardiovascular risk reduction, which that discussion is beyond the scope of this podcast on who should or shouldn't be taking that. But if they are, if they take that about 30 minutes before the dose of the niacin, that can help reduce the flushing as well, because there's a prostaglandin, it's actually a prostaglandin mediated response, which the quercetin I think is helping in that way as well. And then avoiding alcohol, you know, with the niacin is important for the flushing piece. And then it's really important to not interrupt treatment because you want to be consistent with that treatment for niacin. So those are some things to think about. But again, several studies that show decreased coronary events. And so we have even studies that show decreased carotid intermedial thickness, which is a surrogate marker for coronary events. So definitely, you know, one of the supplements that has more studies, but again, one that's a little bit harder to tolerate for some people. And then the next one we're going to talk about is lipids. So these are marine lipids, so not krill oil, but omega-3 fatty acids. And so omega-3 fatty acids, there's a lot out there. So we have your standard fish oil products are typically made up of EPA and DHA. And so both of those have studies that are looking at them decreasing triglycerides. And that's really like where we think about them in therapy, is decreasing triglycerides, but also decreasing inflammation. So inflammation markers like CRP, which is like an overall inflammation score, even improving LDL particle size or HDL particle size, as well as there is a brand name drug that is an omega-3 fatty acid, an EPA formulation that does the SEPA, it's isocopent ethol, but it is actually got data for reductions in cardiovascular disease endpoints and events. So that's something to consider. It's interesting that the studies that have the reduction in cardiovascular disease events tend to be the EPA formulations. But when we look at other data for like every surrogate marker, the DHA outperforms EPA. So generally, I recommend a mix of both. And the other thing we can do is actually look, and when we think about functional medicine lab testing, we can actually look deeper and see, are you you deficient in EPA? Are you deficient in DHA? And actually target the percentages that you're taking of each to your specific situation. So that's really important. And then they also have anti-inflammatory effects, like I mentioned, antithrombotic effects. And with that, if you are taking like a blood thinning medication, the too much fish oil or omega-3 fatty acids can increase risk of bleeding. So that's a common question for patients that we're going to be, you know, evaluating, especially in these patients that are high risk for cardiovascular syndrome. And a little bit of information about improving insulin resistance, lowering blood pressure, heart rate. So definitely some good anti-inflammatory. And I will say, I've said this a lot, that I have never tested a patient that lives in the United States, which I treat most patients in Ohio, but most of our patients that I have tested, I don't see like normal EPA, DHA, unless they're supplementing. So I think that's sort of one of our core supplements from the standard American diet standpoint, and even not the standard American diet. I mean, it's really hard to get enough fish, flaxseed oil, other things in our diet to have enough of a EPA and DHA. Veronica, I think you wanted to share a tip that you have about fish oil.
Yes. I would like for our listeners to test the quality of the fish oil product that they've chosen. Take your bottle, stick it in the freezer for several hours, and then take it out. If your capsules are cloudy when you take it out from being in the freezer, it means that you don't have a high quality fish oil product. It hasn't been filtered properly to have just the omega-3 fatty acids that we want in that product. So if you test your fish oil and it gets cloudy, then contact one of us from Farm to Table so we can help direct you to a good, clean fish oil product that is going to stay clear when you pop it in the freezer to test it.
Awesome. Yeah. And if you do have trouble with fishy burps, which we also have products that you don't taste fishy burps, but if your product is clean and you still have trouble with fishy burps, then freezing it also helps with that. And making sure that you're not putting it like on the top of your meal, like you're just taking it at the beginning of the meal, can help be helpful too.
You can also look for products that are formulated with some lemon oil or some orange oil. And that really helps with the fishy burps too. If you're not sensitive to the citrus oils, those are good formulations too.
Yes. Yes. And even one of the ones I like has some turmeric in it as well. And also I think some glutathione in it as well. So it helps with some of these other antioxidant pieces that in these fat soluble things that need that lipid carrier, they put it in the fish oil. So yeah. And then the other one that is common is red yeast rice. So the things we need to say about red yeast rice is that there are products that can be harmful out there. There are products on the shelf that have been tested that are red yeast rice that have had impurities in them. But red yeast rice does have statin-like effects. So it blocks the same enzyme that statins, and actually statins were sort of discovered by looking at this red yeast rice molecule, but it does not deplete CoQ10 as much as statins. And the other thing about red yeast rice is that it has more polyphenols and more antioxidants as part of it. So when we think about some of the risk for diabetes, and again, we don't have a comparison on what red yeast rice does to the gut versus what statin does to the gut, but I would suspect that not isolating and having more of a whole food type product probably isn't going to shift the microbiome as much. But again, that's pure speculation. So just, you know, less side effects, not as much muscle pain because there's not as much CoQ10 depletion, but you definitely have to get a good product, make sure what you're taking is actually red yeast rice. So there's some great products out there. Zymogen has some great products. Biotis Research has some great products. So as far as the red yeast rice component goes, and other companies that we work with as well. And then ALA. So ALA is interesting. It's alpha-linolenic acid. And this is a dietary, so this is actually from flax. So if we look at, but this is a lot of flax. So it's about 14 grams to 40 grams of flaxseed per day, but it can reduce total cholesterol, LDL, LP little a, triglycerides. It's also anti-inflammatory and also has some data for reducing the cardiovascular risk and total. So that's really something I think that is important about these pieces here, is that these actually have some data in some of these hard endpoints. And some additional things, though, to think about from a cardiovascular risk standpoint. And it's funny because there are people out there that have like a tackle box of supplements that they take every day for cardiovascular risk reduction. And we're not saying that that's wrong for some people or that it's not, you know, it's what everyone should do. I think that everyone needs to individualize their therapy and figure out what's going to be the most beneficial for them. And sometimes that's challenging. And that's why we always recommend patients work with a provider, whether it's us or another provider, to sort of navigate where you're spending your money and where you're getting your biggest bang for your buck and where you're getting these nutrients from your diet and where you're pulling in the lifestyle pieces. But as far as other things that we should be thinking about, fiber, fiber, fiber. So if you measure, so I would challenge our listeners to, if you are wanting to make an impact on their cholesterol, measure, take a diet, like a diary, a food diary, of how much fiber that you're taking in your daily diet. You can use apps like MyFitnessPal to look up fiber content, or there's all kinds of other apps out there, have the food labels and things like that. So 30 to 50 grams of total fiber is going to really help the cholesterol that we do eat to not get absorbed as much. And then at least 10 grams should really be soluble fiber. And this also pulls out bile acids. And so bile is where we make, when we make bile, we make it from cholesterol. So then when we pull out bile acids, then we're like recycling that and producing more bile and using up that cholesterol. So we help with this like whole cycle. So it also improves the microbiome, which has positive impacts on the on some of the lipids and the blood sugars. So it's really, really important to look at that and increase fiber in the diet and get that diversity and diversities of fibers too, not just 50 grams of the same type of fiber. And then garlic is a popular one. So about 600 milligrams a day, twice a day, actually, of the garlic is what has typically been studied for cholesterol. Pomegranate seeds are really good anti-inflammatory, or about 6 ounces of the juice. But if you're having trouble regulating the blood sugars, the juice might not be the best option, or having yeast or bacterial issues in the gut, the juice could be challenging. But berberine is another one that we use that actually we use for blood sugar control, but also helps with triglycerides, LDL, and total cholesterol. And so that's something to think about. And then the other thing is olive oil. So I've had multiple lectures where cardiologists are talking about how they like drink olive oil. I don't know about you guys, if you can drink it. I can't drink it, but I can cover my salad. I know, right?
No,
it's like very peppery if you have a really high quality olive oil. So it's challenging to like get that down, but you can use it on your salads, on your, you know, if you're having a loaf of bread, or, you know, not a loaf, but you know what I mean? Like a piece of bread. If you're putting a baked potato or whatever you're doing, you could, if you're using a little butter, you can mix some butter and olive oil to get more olive oil. Ideally 3 to 4 tablespoons a day of olive oil, of a good quality olive oil. It is challenging in the United States to find olive oil that is not tainted with other types of oils. So, I mean, I just try to do my best. There are some farms that are in California that are producing olive oils. I realize for as much olive oil as my family goes through, I'm not sure I can spend the money on the bottle from the California farm, but I try to look for the organic label, try to make sure that it's a dark color, that it's in a dark container so that it's not affected by the light in transit as much. So do your best. I don't know if you guys have a brand of olive oil that you guys typically use to recommend. No. Okay. That's okay. I right now probably buy the, I can buy the Costco organic.
No, I look at the label, like
organic kinds, but I should write Kirkland and say, can I find out if you've tested this? So if anyone out there is listening and works for them, like let us know if your olive oil is pure. Maybe we'll try to find out. But the monounsaturated fatty acid component of that is really what's important. And it's also found in nuts. So if you can increase nuts in your diet, that's great. Decreases LDL triglycerides. It helps with epigenetic changes in your genes as well, and sort of decreasing that that inflammatory response. So there's even been studies with like olive oil extract and different inflammatory conditions and eye conditions. And like, it's pretty cool how much those monounsaturated fatty acids are doing in our bodies. And then as far as other like lipid panel type things in supplements, curcumin is one that we think a lot of for anti-inflammatory. It helps dampen that inflammatory response and turn off some of those cytokine responses that we talked about that are causing the damage and causing these lipid sort of particles to get stuck. It doesn't affect the lipid panel as far as shifting LDL. You might see a little bit of decrease in LDL particle size, or improvement in particle size. So increase in particle size, decrease in small LDL, but we don't see a lot with changes in the panel as much as just, you know, overall inflammation. While this isn't a supplement, but the exercise has also been shown to positively affect LDL and, you know, have other positive benefits to the heart. So certainly making sure that you work with your provider, find out if exercise is appropriate for you. Certainly some people may have injuries that prohibit certain exercise, but make sure if you can exercise and don't have any limitations, that you want a balance of cardio and a balance of weightlifting, because both of those are really important. So when we think about the whole picture of insulin resistance and inflammation, the weight training type exercise is inflammation and helps with that insulin resistance component. So we covered a lot there really fast, but if you want more nitty gritty of, you know, doses and figuring out what your biggest bang for your buck is going to be as far as supplement regimen, that's where we can get into individualized clinical consults with patients. We have a supplement consult if you just have some quick questions about some of these supplements, a brief supplement consult, and then we also have our functional medicine consults as well. So Veronica is going to talk to us a little bit about diet changes and how that impacts heart disease and cholesterol.
Yes, diet is huge. It's exciting to know that we can change our health destiny by changing the foods that we eat. So it's really important that we avoid processed and packaged foods as much as possible. And when we can't avoid them, that we're reading labels and looking for very simple whole foods ingredients that we can recognize the names of with few chemicals, and avoiding trans fats. So anytime you see hydrogenated in the name, you know that that's an ingredient that contains trans fats. And also mono and diglycerides are another ingredient that you may see on labels that can indicate that there could be some trans fats in the foods that you're choosing to eat. And they do tricky marketing with different food products. You'll see on a label contains 0 grams of trans fats, and patients will reach for that thinking, oh, that's a good product. But when you read the label, it's actually got 0.5 gram, so less than 1 gram per serving. And so they can technically label it as 0 grams trans fat because it's less than 1 gram. Mm-hmm. And so you're actually getting a small portion with every serving. And imagine you consume the whole box of that packaged product. So you've consumed actually quite a bit of trans fats. Mm-hmm. So processed and packaged foods can make it challenging for us to avoid these fats that contribute to heart disease. Whole foods are going to be our best bet for managing high cholesterol, because all that fiber that's in fruits and vegetables is like a mop. Melody mentioned earlier that it helps to decrease the amount of cholesterol that's absorbed from our diet because it's mopping up with all those good fibers. And we like to encourage our patients to get 7 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables and make them very colorful when you're choosing them, because those colorful compounds in your plants, those contain antioxidants, and antioxidants help decrease the oxidative damage that Melody talked about that contributes to inflammation. And the more plants that we can eat, the more antioxidants and protection that we get from our food.
Yeah, I love that. I love when Deanna Minnick talks about the rainbow, and she's found in studies that the red foods will decrease your risk of heart attack, and that the orange ones can decrease your risk of cardiovascular disease. It's kind of cool how
nature does it best.
Nature works. And
I was just going to say that herbs, spices and herbs, make your food fun and creative, because plants have all of these protective chemicals like oregano oil. It has fabulous health benefits and antioxidant properties. So when we cook with that, we get all of those great benefits. So the more herbs that we can incorporate into our foods, it makes our food fun and flavorful, but it's also another way to kick up those good plant compounds to help protect our heart.
Yeah, awesome. Well, any final thoughts we want to have about cholesterol? I know we didn't get super far into like when to use this supplement versus this supplement and drugs, but it just gets really complex. And I think in this space, there are certainly national guidelines, and we, you know, look at those, we look at the patient specifics. There are newer drugs besides statins that lower LDL very low, and we didn't get a lot into that, but there's a lot of data showing really high cholesterol is bad, often because it's accompanied from this inflammation. I think we're still trying to figure out how low is too low. And I think Veronica and I were talking about that a little bit before we started the podcast. So those are kinds of things that we have to think about, you know, from a hormone standpoint. And some of the companies are starting to study that when they're driving these LDL numbers to 20s and 30s. But it's something that I think is still, that's still trying to figure all of that out. But again, like if a person, I think the key will be like what are looking at these whole risk assessment and not just the regular lipid panel, and looking at someone's lifestyle factors, looking at their diet and their nutrition, and seeing what we can do there first is going to be really important to influencing outcomes. And, you know, it's going to be a different choice for me as a clinician if someone has a really high Lp(a) and a myeloperoxidase that's high versus someone that doesn't and has the exact same cholesterol panel. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that as far as like recommendations to patients for certain things.
Yeah, pretty patient specific.
Well, and patient preference too. Even though a patient may have higher risk factors, their preference may be to start with more diet and lifestyle. Even if we're thinking, ooh, they probably do need a statin, but it's not their choice, to support them in that and help them get the most bang for their buck in the interventions that they are willing to do. And again, making it personalized and honoring the patient's choice as well.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. It's a balance between like doing no harm, right? Doing no harm and recommending the, you know, most appropriate choice we think of based on evidence, and then, you know, supporting patients' choices. And I think that's a really important piece about choosing a provider that respects your opinions and your wishes as you're going through whatever health condition it is. If someone is not willing to have that conversation with you and you know, presents, you know, the, I mean, everything has a pro con, whether I sleep for 8 hours or I sleep for 6 hours has a pro or con, you know, right? Whether I eat this apple or I don't eat this apple, like there's positive and negative benefits. So I think that's the thing that is important in this discussion with patients is looking at, this is evidence we have for this, this is evidence we have for this. And we can't decide if you're going to be that, you know, one in 25 person that gets that benefit or one, you know, or not. So we have to, we'll do our due diligence and really dive into all these lifestyle things too, which I think is really one of the, you know, the biggest key is a Mediterranean diet. Like we talked about with all those fruits and vegetables and colorful things. I mean, we talk about the Mediterranean diet like all the time. So if you're listening to the podcast and you just want to skip over, you can figure we're talking about stress, right? We're talking about stress and stress reduction. We're talking about eating a clean Mediterranean diet. And we're talking about supplementing the vitamin D and fish oil, right? That's like the main the main big things. No, I'm just kidding. But those are some of the things that come up a lot when, you know, we're talking about all of these things. So
like it might go all over, but yeah, I mean, you can take those little tips, and if you need a first step, start there, and then
I think a lot of people just want to grab supplements to replace the drug options, and providers and patients, right? But in reality, I think we have to, it has to be a blend. It has to be the dietary piece. We can't out supplement a bad diet. We say that a lot, but the same, you know, goes with the stress management. We can't fix all of the things wrong with your body if you don't rest and don't take the time for the deep breathing and the box breathing that we talk about and all that. So Veronica, do you want to end us in a box breathing exercise? We're talking about stress.
Yes, I would love to. In fact, I did some box breathing to prepare for the podcast.
Awesome. So why don't you like tell people what it is, and then you can lead us.
So a box breath is one where you breathe in for a certain number. We'll just say two. You breathe in for two. Then you hold your breath for two counts. Then you breathe out for two counts. And then you hold your breath again for two counts. And you start the process over. And this is a very calming and grounding breath. It helps you tap in to your vagus nerve. This is the part of your nervous system that turns on your relaxation responses and prepares your body to rest and digest. And this is a great breath that you can use anytime you're feeling anxious or scared and stressed. This is a great breath to use. In fact, they teach this to Navy SEALs and military personnel. This is a breath that they use to calm and center themselves. So if it works for Navy SEALs, it's going to work for you.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's take just a moment To get centered, if you'd like, you can close your eyes, put your feet flat on the floor, relax the shoulders away from the ears, and let your hands rest comfortably in your lap. And just notice your body. And now let's draw a big breath in for two counts, hold for two, breathe out for two, and hold for two. Breathe in for two, hold for two, breathe out for two, and hold for two. So we're our last one, in for two, hold for two, breathe out for two, and hold for two. And then take just a moment and let your breath come back to a natural and effortless rhythm and notice how you feel. And as you're ready, you can open your eyes and bring your awareness back into the room.
Awesome. You're welcome. Thank you.
I should have prefaced that with don't do it while you're driving.
I know, right? Hopefully
they took that cue.
People got that one. Right. I know. Podcast. That's what I do when I drive. Listen to podcasts. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for listening. And we hope that this information is helpful. And if you have questions or want to dive deeper into what this might look like for your personal situation, you can find us at farmtotable, farmtotable.life. And we hope to see you again soon. Thanks for listening. We're excited you are on your journey with us. Find us online at farmtotable.life, farm with a P, and on Instagram at farmtotableteam.